attitude. We are going to energise the country.
Stop Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Seamus, I'm not sure this is a great idea.
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. In this episode, I'm joined by a great British actor and writer, Stephen McGann, to discuss a BAFTA award-winning TV series, The Hanging Gale. Welcome to the podcast, Stephen.
Hello there, Will. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you on. Now, to begin with, I'd just like to ask, do you think you could explain what the series is about for those who might... not know what it's about?
Right. Many, many moons ago, it's over 25 years ago now, I had an idea with my brother Joe to tell the story of my, basically the story of my family history, which was related to the Irish potato famine. I wanted to go back, and in four parts in the series, The Hanging Gale is a story of an absolute national and international disaster, one of the greatest causes of human movement in modern history, expressed through a single family. It's a fictional family. It's not my own family's personal history, but it's all of the circumstances which led, like, for instance, my own family to live in Britain rather than be in Roscommon in Ireland. And it was a four-part series for the BBC, went out on a Sunday night in 1995, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was all related to the failing of a potato crop, if you don't know what the potato famine is, very, very briefly. The Irish in the 1800s, for the first half of the 1800s, existed and in fact thrived on a very precarious crop, being the potato. The potato is incredibly nutritious, and the poor population of Ireland then, of course, administrated and ruled as part and inside the British Empire. They managed to subsist remarkably well on this single unique crop, which was prone to periodic failure. In the mid-1840s, they had reached near starvation for a number of years in the first half of the 1800s, but in the mid-1840s, disaster struck. The potato blight, which still affects crops today, struck the Irish crop, but continued to strike the Irish crop for a period of about 4 or 5 years. It became, it basically wiped out the Irish population. It caused the emigration, which we later understood as an Irish reality. It caused political strife. It probably led to the beginnings of the Troubles as we now understand them. It led to the rise of Irish nationalism. It was a national disaster. It was a disaster as much for the, well, not as much, but it was a disaster that also affected the British as well.
Now, in the series, you mentioned Irish nationalism there. In the series, your character, Daniel Phelan, is involved with the sort of more radical Irish activism, whereas Liam, Father Liam, played by your brother Paul, he attempts to get more attention to the failure of the crop by writing to the Times and trying to publish accounts of what was happening. Ooh. How do you think these two sort of sides, the more sort of like the radical side, and the more communicative, the perhaps more literate side of the responses to the famine, impacted on the way that it was seen around the world?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's a complex question too. When something disastrous happens like this, the levels of the mess up, as it were, the levels of lack of response, there are a lot of ways in which it scarred, I think it's looking from the outside, it scarred the modern Irish mind, because there wasn't one villain and one angel in the middle of all of it. And there were many attempts by many people on all sides to try and ameliorate the problems that were presented to them. radicalism only grew up in the, I think, ham-fisted attempts and sometimes, wicked ignorance back in Britain, but not exclusively ignorance, but also the lack of understanding of the British, and to listen to the needs and the cares of the people suffering at the parliamentary level, led to the rise later on of the problems which Britain later had in the modern age of Ireland. So therefore, the different voices, you had the radicals, you had early radical movements. There wasn't the Irish Republican Army at that time, but there were organizations like the Molly Maguires and the Ribbon Men. These were throughout the 1800s. Ireland learned to be secret. Ireland learned, part of radical Ireland, learned to become guerrilla movements and to hide themselves. And a lot of people would argue better than me and more expert than me that the reason that came around was a desperation, because at a national and a governmental level, Ireland was signally being failed by structured law and by organization. The public works, for instance, were a scheme set up to try, a wonderfully Victorian scheme set up to try and provide aid to the starving Irish. But being Victorian in its character and very British in its character, it had an inbuilt bigotry against the Irish and believed them work shy. So the public works were predicated on the idea that you would give people Indian corn, they called it, corn imported from the United States, instead of the potatoes that were no longer there. You would give them starvation rations. But to do that, you couldn't simply give the Irish this food, because they were considered work shy. And it was considered to the Victorian mind that it would encourage more idleness, even though these people were starving. So what they had to do for their corn was they had to go out and do public works. You basically, it was job creation. You created roads in the west of Ireland, roads that weren't asked for, that went nowhere. But you had to, the poor and starving people had to be seen to be working, to work for their corn, even though they were in the advanced stages of starvation. It was this kind of, if you're being at most kind, ham-fisted, bigoted, through the wrong filter view of the problems out in Ireland, at its best, and at its worst, it was simply ignoring the reality of it and enabling radicalism to develop underneath the surface that was then expressed in the character I played in The Hanging Gael. And Paul's character is the priest. There were always a priestly class there. There were people involved in politics there. There were people involved in social care. There were landlords who were Irish. There were sellers and merchants who were Irish. So these people were compromised by the situation. There was profiteering by the Irish. And you've got to say, you've got to accept also, there would have been Irish merchants who profited from the misery of their fellow people. That wasn't the main driving force, but it would have been a hangover and a side effect of the complexity of that awful bloody situation. And you have to, through drama, you have to show that all. You can't simply show one. It wouldn't be fair simply to show one side. However, the overriding thing was that it was, at best, and at kindest, it was spectacularly badly handled and probably quite institutionally cruel. And the problems caused by that are still a scar to today.
You mentioned the British response, and in the series, there's a lot of ire. He's directed against the character played by Michael Kitchen, who is the land agent, William Townsend. Now, there are parts of the series where his character seems perhaps a bit more sympathetic towards the plight of the Irish, and then there are other times when his character is really quite harsh and quite brutal to the people of Ireland. How representative do you think that is of land agents at the time?
Some land agents, it's interesting, and I would count them as a profound minority, were very kind. So if you said, oh, nobody, everybody was cool. No, that's pantomime. That's not really the case. That's the first thing to say. And some were unspeakably cruel. And land agents were different. They were as different as the people, the attitudes, the way they worked with the local people in their care. That was the first thing. The second thing is a more general point about historical drama, which is interesting as regards someone like Michael Kitchen's character, is whenever you're going into history, and I'm also, my other half is an adapter of historical drama, fiction drama, and one of the fascinating things about history, even recent history, is that you've got to try and transplant your mind with here we are, 2019 mindset, back to the minds and the mores of people who may as well be alien to many of the things we understand these days. So when you're thinking about Michael Kitchen's character, you're saying, well, it might have been absolutely right and proper for this man to express a Christian care in the way and the filter, the way he understood it, but also like the sort of that strange sort of empire mindset of the great white, you know, carer for his people, you know, the empire were the children of these people. We find that a monstrous construct now for a lot of good reasons. But what's interesting when you go back to drama, because you're going back to try and get into the heads of people, and you're trying to look at evidence to say, well, how did these people live their lives? How did they get up in the morning? What was the moral world in which they lived? A lot of it was to do with their religion, the way that God had made the poor man at his gate, or the Irish peasant in his clachan, and the English overlord, by his part and his duty, was to care for the people. But if the people stepped too much out of line, and if the people didn't do things in the proper Christian Victorian way, then it was right to bring out the king, and it was right to do those things. So those moral structures, sometimes you look at those things, beautifully scripted as it was by Alan Cubitt, because what me and Joe did is we had a treatment, so we worked on a detailed story idea, a treatment, but it was scripted up by the brilliant and much garlanded Alan Cubitt, and I think he brought out very, very cleverly that this different world, looking at an alien in a different planet, you know, the past being a foreign country, as they said, and this foreign specimen of someone you vaguely recognize, someone you can see goodness in, and then you get interested that you see this other brute turn in them, and his desires and his cares get twisted up in the disaster affecting everybody around. Basically, everybody is ruined by this. I believe Britain is ruined by this. Britain's actions, like any great nation's actions, Britain can blight itself and has done many times, because if one covers something up, if one is a brute, one cannot shake that brutality easily off and resolve it with other things that you truly are. And a bit expressed in the relationship of Michael Kitchen, there are good things in this man, but if those things don't resolve, then there can be ruin. There is ruin in that. There is compromising, you know?
Now, you mentioned the sense of Christian responsibility and the whole underlying theme of this sort of like this sense that the British were the sort of white Christian saviours. Do you think that part of the tension that existed around the famine was partly because Ireland was mainly a Catholic country and Britain was predominantly a Protestant nation? Do you think that that was part of the reason that there wasn't perhaps more support for the Irish during the famine?
I think that, and here's an interesting, if tenuous, that you cannot remove, and I am no expert, I will say this, and my disclaimer straight away, I'm not a great historian of Ireland. I am an expert in the intricacies of Irish history. I know a little. But what I do know in that time was that you cannot remove from what then happened in the mid-1800s in the famine from the Act of Union, I think it was 1801, and from the penal laws which affected the Catholics in the previous century, leading to the 1800s. Catholics weren't treated the same. Most people in the nation were Catholics. And with the rebellions that had happened and the alignment of people, somebody put it beautifully, I can't remember now, in Irish history, the great tragedy of the relationship between the British and the Irish throughout history is every time the British seemed to rise in the world and have a moment of gain, it seemed to be Ireland's doom. Mm. And every time England was in peril, Ireland saw a gain from that. It's like two sides of a seesaw, and they've never been resolved in peaceful alignment. Now, for the Catholics, I think, you know, you touch on the right point where their Catholicism mattered, but the Catholicism was all tied up already with the politics of their treatment. For instance, until the emancipation, I think it was in the 1830s, the Catholics couldn't even be in government. Mm. They weren't allowed certain things. It was a bit like in other nations where Jewish people weren't allowed to be in, you know, you couldn't go quite high up. You couldn't be in principle. It was a kind of apartheid. And it came because of the earlier rebellions, suppressing of the population of the Irish. Basically, you could take the Anglican shilling, you could join the Church of Ireland. And especially during the famine, there were times when Catholics converted to the Church of Ireland, there were times and in places where that could make it easier for them. There was always this degree of suppression on the Catholicism, which was inextricably linked with politics coming in from the previous century. So that's one thing. And then there's this more philosophical side to the Catholic nature, which was to do, I think, with suffering. It's the nature of suffering in this world for salvation in the next, which might have fed in psychologically to it. But I think the 1800s is a gradual story of, at the beginning, one might argue that at the beginning of the 1800s and throughout the intermittent famines before the mid-1800s, the Irish were not a nation in their mind. They didn't see themselves. There wasn't a movement, a solid, clear movement for Irish nationalism. My God, by the end of that century, there was every kind of movement, not simply in Ireland, but interestingly enough, in the Irish diaspora, where where my forebears ended up in Liverpool. There were actually Irish nationalist MPs in north of Liverpool who were, even though they were in England, they were campaigning for something back in the old country, which early in that century had never been thought of. And one could then argue that it was the actions then of British power expressed through Ireland at that time, which crystallized a narrative of nationalism which wasn't there. So it wasn't just Catholicism, but it was the way that Catholicism had been placed in the hierarchy and how that then fused into Catholic politicization, Catholic radicalism. So Catholicism, as it later did in the Troubles in the North, became inextricably linked. Religion became inextricably linked with political alignment. And so if you look for the roots of what certain politicians in Britain, even nowadays, if you look in recent history, I can't remember who it was, you'll tell me, Will, but, you know, the Minister for Ireland who came back with wide eyes and said, oh, I never realised that you know, Protestant people tend to vote for one political side in Northern Ireland and Catholic people vote for the other. Yeah. Like, never ever. This was the Northern Ireland minister, like page one stuff. But the roots of that, I think, have the roots right back in the 1800s. They have where, by treating a religious huge sector of the population politically differently, combined with starvation, combined with ill treatment, combined with desperation, fused into a radicalism that was then inextricably tied in with the religious faith.
I wonder, going on from that, do you think that the way that the relationship between Ireland and England is now, had the famine not happened, do you think that there would be the same sense of anger, the same sense of justified hatred at the way that the Irish were treated that's then fed down into later generations? Or do you think that the way that Ireland and England would have interacted now had the famine not happened been entirely different?
Really, I mean, that is a $64,000, but it's a fascinating question. How can I answer that? First of all, I would say, regarding the famine, there is absolutely no doubt that the roots of the troubles to understand Ireland is a 500-600-year project. You cannot separate the tensions and the troubles that afflicted my young life and the lives of people living in Ireland right now, right today. You cannot separate famine from that. You also cannot separate, for people in the loyalist community, you cannot separate the modern striving of identity from the transplantation of people in the 1700s. You can't. It's hundreds of years old, this. You can't just wave it away with your hand as an inconvenience to both sides. You can't do that. That's why one of the great wisdoms of the peace process and the Good Friday Agreement was a very grown-up, wise, difficult, complex acknowledgement that on both sides that one cannot take the will to exist from either side, because by doing that you have to acknowledge the complex history on both sides. I think that was so deeply wise, and that's what we risk throwing away with our carelessness in the process with Brexit now. Back to the famine, I think the famine was inextricably linked to the sharpness of the rebellions of the 1916s, the partition in 1922. It's a development of the Irish Republican Army, the Provisional IRA, the real IRA. So yes, it's in there. Would it have happened had the famine not happened? And of course, there are so many variables. You cannot say that, no, it would never have happened. Would it have been different? Very possibly. So vexatious has been the relationship between Great Britain and Ireland. There have been chances throughout history where opportunities have presented themselves for a form of peace. There have been missed chances throughout history. 1922, I would personally regard as a missed chance to get it right, causing more heartache on all sides. I think there would still have been tensions in the relationship between these two places, but those tensions may have been able to find a process, like later happened, by which both countries could respect each other and begin to move on. When we did the Hanginghale, it was a very specific, very outrageously naive. We as four English boys with Irish blood, incredibly naive. In fact, our naivety got us through, because nobody in Ireland was attempting to do this, because it's such a wound. And when we went over and tried to do this, people saw our sincerity and came out, thank God, to bring their talents and skills to it. But really, it was to come back to the BBC and to show the British a part of their history that they had actually not been given the respect to see through drama in an open light. And at the time when it was shown, a lot of people said, you know, some newspapers are not going to like this, and you know, the British aren't going to like being seen in this. You know what, they were fantastic. Ratings were fabulous, awards were won. But my favorite exchange what in Britain was, when it first went out, I was on a train into town, and some woman come over to me and she said, "It's you, innit? You're one of those boys, innit? You've done that Irish thing on telly." And I thought, oh God, here it comes. We're going to get it in the neck. And this woman said, "I think it's terrible what we did to them Irish. I think it's bloody awful." But what I then found was the British, the people are fine. The people can look at these things in context, whether you have our behavior in India. You know, if you have an empire like this, if you do what we did in our past. We're all grown-ups. We can look and contextualize those things without making ourselves or childishly trying to shove them some things under the carpet. I believe we're bigger than that. For the Irish, it was an interesting thing. For the Irish I knew over there, it was an interesting exercise in being confronted with something none of them particularly wanted necessarily to look closely at, because it was painful. This is painful. It's a form of starvation. It's subjugation for some people. And also for people on the other side, you've got to understand that it was a wonderful cross-community project. BBC Northern Ireland was very much cross-community. Our crew was half from the Protestant community, half from the Catholic community. Some people came up from the Republic. Some people were living in the six counties in good Protestant communities. We filmed in parts of the Protestant North. We filmed in parts of the Republican South. We were called crossing the border at the time when there were still soldiers on the border. At that time, with a crew that talked and felt fellowship. And a wonderful thing, I go off at a tangent, something I think is really worth bringing up from that Nightingale, is that when we were filming, the ceasefire of 1994 happened while we were actually out there filming. And which, for context, what happened in the ceasefire is it was the first, if you like, non-gunshot in the peace process. It was the first time. What happened was the IRA declared a historic ceasefire. They basically said, we've been talking to each other on all sides. We are going to put our hands up and say, today, we are going to put down our weapons right now and talk. And they made a speech, and it was such a momentous moment. So it's the first opening salvo, or non-salvo, in became the peace plan, what eventually became, after a few hiccups, the Good Friday Agreement. On set that day was the most remarkable feeling. For all the people on all sides, there was tearful relief. I get tears in my eyes even talking to you now about it. There was tearful relief and this remarkable maturity on all sides. Protestants talking to Catholics, saying, you know, I like what they're saying. Do you like what your guys say? Yeah, I think that your guys got a lot of wisdom here. And you realized, from a visitor like me and my family were, you realized, A, exactly what it means, B, what it has cost, and C, how we must, as English, even though I have Irish blood, I am English, how what the efforts we must go to understand this situation. And right up to Brexit now, to understand what a border means, to understand how in blood that border was made and fought over, and how all both those people that day, how they so wanted peace, and it all cost all of them. And I will never forget that, and that informs all of my desires for the modern Irish Republic, for those wonderful six counties, whatever faith anyone has there, or whatever side of any community they live on. I want the same thing all of them on my film set wanted that day. The problems that go back are all back to things like the famine, but even back to Cromwell, for God's sake, you know, William of Orange. Now, you can move on from them, but you have to understand why they're valid to people, the amount of blood that's being spilled, and respect. Move on to respective communities and everybody meeting somewhere in the middle. You know, and we cannot come in, Britain cannot make the mistake of A, ignoring Ireland again, and B, considering that British solutions are an answer to Irish problems, like we've always done. It's the biggest mistake, and it means we kill not only other people, we kill ourselves as well.
You mentioned the sense of that when you were making the series, that there was this sense of coming together and this beginnings of the healings of the very sort of like deeply intrinsic wounds that had been there for so long. And you mentioned this in your book, Flesh and Blood, and you you talk about how it felt to your ancestors had left Ireland during the famine, and then to come back and to make make the series. Was there something cathartic for you and for the rest of your family to have this sort of like this moment of having left Ireland because of this of this great tragedy, to be able to come back and to show other people the absolute horror of what happened, and to sort of like let that deep pain come out in a way that could help people understand?
I think that's true. It was deeply cathartic to us. Why? Because drama, when you try to make it your best, is cathartic. That's literally almost, you know, from the Greek, that's what you have a purging. You come through. That great old phrase from the South African Mandela years, truth and reconciliation. Truth and reconciliation. I'm a great believer. Drama is very powerful for truth and reconciliation. One should never be scared of the light and shade that lies within your own personal history as a human character, your family's personal history, the things that I have. One shouldn't be scared of the light or the shade of that. In my own family tree, I've got some disreputable people in it. And in my book, Flesh and Blood, I almost revel in the fact that some of them were not the most upstanding of citizens. So I don't, it's not a hagiography, it's not, you know, whitewashing of things. I don't like that. Actually, we're bigger than that, and drama is more effective and catharsis is more effective when you actually bring this stuff out and say, this is terrible, but here we are now, and I'm not them. I'm not Michael Kitchen's character. I am here. I'm not you. I'm not the modern Irish Republic either. You know, but here's where we are. What do we think about this? What do we all think about this? Shall we get an idea or a view about this, and can we move on? Truth and reconciliation, ironically, as I always touch on in the book, you know, I talk a lot in my book about what then happened. If you like, part of my book is after we fled, so we get to Liverpool in one of the worst slums in the British Empire. The Irish who fled to Liverpool ended up in appalling conditions, in which my family toiled for 30 years, 3 decades. They were in some of the most spectacular slums. And the thing is that in a way, is it's like sort of The Hanging Gale 2. It's like the sequel. It's what happened to my family afterwards, if you like. But also, I touch on in my book that you went, the attitudes and the injustices perpetrated even about that diaspora, that ghetto, if you like, the Irish ghetto that went on in Liverpool, still afflicted my family right into the 20th century. And I argue, I make a more difficult argument, if you like, a more extended or ambitious argument, to say that a lot of the things surrounding the Hillsborough disaster, the football disaster, inherited, which allowed that libel to take hold, go back in the British mind to an attitude towards Liverpool people that itself can trace itself back in the British mind to the Irish people who form a lot of the part of the Liverpool character. And you can actually trace a thing back to old bigotries manifesting themselves through disaster in a responsibility for their own wrongdoing or starvation, or in this case, suffocation. And I make that, I can't make that argument here because it's too complicated to make, but I make it in my book. But the reason I wanted to bring that up is the Hillsborough disaster is nearer than it's ever been to a final healing of a wound, because the best way to heal a wound was the same way in which you finally started to heal the wound of Bloody Sunday, which is to acknowledge it happened. And then when you acknowledge it happened, you validate those people who experienced it on all sides. Then you can bring them together. You, first of all, justice comes in and says, guys, this really happened. We're sorry. This actually did take place. Lots of people were saying it didn't. It did. So let's start from the point that it did. Let's now talk to the people and say, let's hear about your pain. Let's hear everybody's explanation. And that's the way you move on. That's how dramas can be made. That's the purpose of drama within that context. But only when you have truth and reconciliation can you get catharsis, like with some of those poor families, like with some of those poor families in Bloody Sunday, connected again all the way back hundreds of years. You have those things. But only when you acknowledge them. So the final point about all of that, the purpose of drama in The Hanging Gale, the final point I would make is support for my fellow British, which is the ladies, my own citizens. And I you know, express my country very clearly here, is to say, we can say this. We're bigger than this. We can say this. The sky does not cave in. It didn't cave in acknowledging Bloody Sunday. It doesn't cave in acknowledging Hillsborough. It doesn't cave in acknowledging the famine. And it didn't at the time with The Hanging Gale. Its figures express the desire that the British are a great people. They are perfectly capable of acknowledging their own history. The only problems come in are for those minorities in various elites of various places, if you like. I hate that word. Actually, various constituencies in the nation who might not want to acknowledge their history because it breaks a narrative of something else. You know, but I think only by bringing things out, can you move on?
Well, I think that was a great response, and it has been wonderful to have you on the podcast, Stephen. I think this has been a great expression of what drama can do. Thank you very much for being on the podcast.
It's my pleasure, Will. Thank you very much for having me.
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. In this part of the podcast, I'll be speaking to David Llewellyn, a great writer for Big Finish, about his series about Marcus Tullius Cicero. Hello, David.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Why do you think that Cicero, a figure that lived 2,000 years ago, is still so compelling to audiences today?
I think because of how documented his own life was. So I think for one thing, he was a genius in terms of understanding rhetoric and so on. But I think he documented his own life, and he's one of the first major figures in history whose life is well documented. Before the Roman Republic, before the late Republic, everything kind of blurs a little bit into mythology, and so we're never entirely sure, you know, who's being spoken about, whether, you know, there are certain figures who are a little bit vague and mysterious before then, in kind of Western history. So I think with Cicero, he's interesting because we have his letters, we have, you know, his kind of speeches and so on. So he's a well-documented figure, and we can see how his personality changes. So we can form a kind of, in modern language, we can form a kind of psychological profile of him. And we get a feeling for the kind of person he is. You don't always get that. I mean, other sources are unreliable. So Suetonius, when he's writing about, you know, the 12 Caesars or whatever, it's a lot of gossip and hearsay. And he's writing long after these people have died in most of the cases. So with Cicero, he's there, he's in the moment, and you definitely get a sense of who he is when from the letters, I think. So I think that's why he remains an interesting character, because he's kind of the first personality of Rome that we get. Everyone else is an almost mythological figure, and so, you know, but I think with him, we get a sense of who he actually was on a day to day basis.
The series begins with the trial of Sextius Roscius, which is a very sort of.
I'm going to be fluffing the pronunciations all the way. Sextus Roscius.
It's, you know, sort of like one of the most significant trials of the sort of like period, particularly with how it relates to Sulla and Chrysognis and the state of Rome. What do you think it is about this particular trial that so sort of like inflames the imagination? Because I mean, when I was doing ancient history at school, this was one of the sort of the cases that we were taught. There have been, I think there was a TV play about that particular case as well. What do you think it is about this particular case?
I think that it's just ended up being kind of timeless, because I think we still tell those kind of stories. It's got a good story. And I think that's ultimately it, is when you read that, you know, compared with some of the other murder trials he might have worked on, that he's documented. With this one, there's actually lots of intrigue, and there's, you know, it's a son accused of murdering his father, the punishment for which was horrendous.
Mm, yeah.
Found guilty. And there's kind of murmurings of corruption and all the rest of it. I mean, I know there are some classicists and some historians who think Sextus Roscius was probably guilty. Mm. Cicero leaves us with the impression that he was innocent. But, of course, court cases in those days, it wasn't based on forensics or an eyewitness testimony. It was based on which lawyer could argue the case more convincingly. So, but I think it still has, even despite those differences, I think it still has... It's quite Perry Mason, you know. It's still that kind of feeling to it. It feels like a courtroom drama, so it feels familiar to us, and therefore it lends itself well to drama. And I think, I think that's why it's the one that people go back to, and it's the one that appeals to dramatists really. And it's an early case of his, so it's kind of important for Cicero's development as a character as well.
Now, talking about his development as a character, of course there is your great series on Big Finish, which sort of chronicles the earlier stages of his life. And there are also the novels written by Robert Harris that sort of encompasses his whole life. How do you think your sort of like characterization of Cicero differs from Harris's, or do you think that they're sort of like similar or...
Well, I've not read the Robert Harris books, and I think I kind of, when we started doing the series, I made a conscious effort not to, because I didn't want to either end up too similar to that or to go the other way and end up creating this Cicero who's so outlandishly not like the person that we read in his own letters and so on. So I can't really comment on how he's depicted in the Robert Harris books. The only sort of depiction I was overly familiar with is, I can't think of the actor's name, David Thing in Rome. It's David, and I can't think of his name.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But in the TV series Rome, the HBO series. And David Bamber. Is it David Bamber? Anyway, that was the depiction that I was kind of most familiar with, and that is him right at the end of his life. That's as the Republic is coming to an end. Where he's perhaps maybe a slightly more cynical character, but you know, still becomes a kind of martyr to tyranny. You know, he's basically assassinated by somebody who likes him. You know, people to like him. So I don't know. I mean, like I said, with this series, it is very much the first kind of couple of years of him forging a career. And it just so happened that in that year or two, a lot of things happened to him. You know, he got married and went off on this kind of gap year, for want of a better description, over to Greece and Asia Minor and so on. And so it was a very interesting year. But if you read the letters and read the speeches and just look at his history, he changes and he does mature, and in some ways he is kind of corrupted by the power that he ends up having. He does things which probably would have shocked him as a younger man, I think. He's not this kind of, as a young man, he's not this kind of woke, liberal figure. He owns slaves and he's a terrific snob and all the rest of it, because I think, you know, coming from a family that had worked its way up, I think he's always got a bit of a chip on his shoulder about class and things like that. But he's not a modern figure, but I think he did get more conservative by their own standards as he got older. Like I said, I can't compare that to the Robert Harris character, because I've not read the books.
There are a lot of comparisons, though, made recently, particularly in the press, between figures from the ancient world, Cicero, Caesar, Clodius, with modern politicians. How applicable do you think these comparisons are? Or do you think that they sort of like don't really work because these people exist in different contexts?
I think there's some, there are some shallow comparisons that can be made. Yeah, like I said, the context is so different, that I think they'll always just be a kind of, a fancy way of describing it. I think populism is an interesting one, because obviously that did exist in ancient Rome, and it was a device that was used by certain leaders in order to rally support, where they would just kind of say what people wanted to hear. They would use a lower register of the language when they were making speeches. Caesar was quite well known for that, where he would use a lower register, because then it would, and you know, people like Caesar as well, he was from the kind of wrong side of the Tiber, you know. Really, he was from, even though he was from quite an affluent aristocratic family, he grew up in Sibiru, so you know, he grew up in what was essentially a slum, but in a big house in a slum. I think there's certain comparisons to be made with populism, where people will use the masses by promising them certain things to bolster their support, but I don't know, everything else is a bit strained, I think. I think there's more. I always find there are more comparisons with certainly where Britain is at the moment and where Europe is at the moment, with something like, I don't know, Italy in the 15th century, 16th century, rather than ancient Rome is just politically it's a bit too alien, I think. You know, it's democracy doesn't the Republic. Its democracy doesn't resemble the democracy we have. I think it's a bit too alien for those comparisons to actually have much weight.
Now, one of the things that I found interesting, there was a documentary thing on Radio 4 a few years ago about Cicero, and it might have been Robert Harris, but someone commented that they thought that politicians like Cicero don't really exist now because of the way that Cicero sort of like was very much a lawyer who evolved into a politician, but still had a sort of like an element of the legal brain about him. Do you think that in terms of the way that we have politicians now, that perhaps the reason that they go into politics isn't perhaps in the same way that Cicero did, because of his legal career and because of wanting to boost his legal career? Do you think there's sort of like more of an aim towards being a politician for the sake of being a politician, rather than for a particular advancement or cause?
Well, one of the interesting things with Cicero is that he was quite rare at the time for coming not from a military background. Even though he'd done a stint in the army, it was very, he didn't really achieve much in the army. He didn't rise through the ranks or anything like that. And so, he didn't come from a military background. Whereas most of the people who ended up consul, and then obviously almost all of the people who ended up being emperor after that, were from a military background. You know, they were all kind of high ranking within the Roman army. You wouldn't get that class of politicians these days, because it's a totally different sphere, and it's I think the means by which politicians had to appeal to a smaller percentage of the population back then. They could use popular support, they could use the masses and the plebs to kind of win things over, and to give the impression that, oh well, if you vote for anyone else, there's going to be trouble, kind of. It was almost like a kind of protection racket in a way. You wouldn't want riots, you know. Politicians had to appeal to a smaller percentage of the population. They could do so with very long speeches, and they could do so with lots of backroom shaking of hands. And politicians, there's still a lot of backroom shaking of hands, but I think everything's has to be more soundbitey, and it has to be more generic, and it has to be. So I don't think Again, like I said, I think that the it's an alien world to us. What people had to do in order to persuade other people to go along with them was completely different.
Well, we're coming to the end of this part of the podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, David. I'd just like to ask one final question. Where do you think Cicero stands in the history of influential figures? Because I know that there was a famous phrase that history could be divided into before Cicero and after Cicero. Where do you think he stands in comparison to other significant figures of history?
I think he's interesting because he gives us the kind of timeless model of a person with power and influence who stands up against an idea of tyranny very early on. So, I mean, there are other kind of figures, but they tend to be revolutionaries or rebels or whatever. Him, it's words. You know, he's probably one of the earlier figures that we have where, I mean, they were figures in ancient Greece and so on. But I think, he gets in trouble for what he says and is executed for what he says. And for having certain opinions. And so I think that is something which echoes down and, you know, we still have with us now, is this idea that you could be imprisoned or whatever, or banished, sent into exile for having the wrong opinions. I think so that will always echo. And I think we'll always look back to that and the fact that, you know, he had his tongue nailed to the door of the Senate after he was murdered. So I think that's timeless. I think also that there are just things that, you know, there are things in his treatise on rhetoric, which still those, you know, still apply. I think there's still techniques. There's a great book by Sam Leith, I think it's called Are You Talking to Me, which I read before starting work on Cicero. I'd read it before and then I reread it, just because it was he's very good at kind of breaking down Cicero's very long rhetoric into kind of stuff that is maybe more easily understood by the likes of me. It is just surprising how people are still using those techniques, and people use those techniques without realizing what they're doing. That's the other interesting thing. So that kind of, even though we speak a different language, even though the language Cicero was writing and speaking in is kind of to all intents and purposes dead, I think that influence carries on, and obviously he was being influenced by others, so it doesn't start with him. I think a lot of what we would now recognize as history starts there, documented, verifiable history, because before then, with Herodotus and stuff, it is borderline mythology. It does veer into myth making.
Well, thank you very much for being on the podcast, David.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'd highly recommend that you buy the Cicero series from Big Finish. It's an excellent series, and I don't think that you could have a better representation of the young Cicero. So thank you once again. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Debated Podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify. Follow us on Twitter at Debated Podcast. And if you want to send us an email, send it to thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget that For a Better Politics is launching on the 24th, so in a couple of days. I would highly encourage you to find out more about that. And thank you for listening to the episode. Hope you listen to the next one.